This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You want to bet Greece is going to leave the Eurozone? Yeah, too bad. You really can't anymore. Some big, big losses at JP Morgan Chase. And also Brad Pitt, in case you hadn't heard, is the new face of Chanel No. 5. Today, some possible taglines for the coming ad campaign. Here's one. Use Chanel No. 5, because you kind of smell. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 10th of May. It's Thursday today. Good to have you with us. You know, there are in this world very few sure things, but if I were a betting man, I'd be tempted to lay down a couple of bucks that Greece will be the first country to leave the Eurozone. Sadly, that bet got harder to make today. Both Ladbrokes and William Hill, the two big London bookmakers, have suspended that bet. Seems it was just too much of a sure thing given the elections this past weekend and the continuing mess. We've called Graham Sharp at William Hill to discuss. Mr. Sharp, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So how tight were the odds when you suspended betting on Greece being the first to leave the Eurozone?
Well, at that point, if you wanted to have the bet that the Greeks would exit first from the Eurozone, you would win for your stake of, let's say, €4, $4, £4, a profit of just one. You would obviously get the four back as well. What you would call in betting parlance, a pretty warm favorite, if not necessarily a red-hot one.
Yeah. Why did you suspend the betting? I mean, it sort of makes sense, because if anybody's going to leave, they are. But aren't you guys experts in setting these odds?
Well, yes, and this market's been open for some while. And at this point, all we were being asked to take was bets for Greece to be the first to go. And so where you've got a situation that's volatile and difficult to keep up with, and you don't have representation on the ground, as we don't there, things can change quite quickly, and if you're not aware of them, then you might be offering a particular betting price, which as far as you're concerned is quite reasonable, but as far as people that know a little bit more than you, it's virtually the equivalent to giving away free money on Christmas Day.
Which is bad for business. But how do you...
It's certainly not the way your ideal bookmaker would like to go about ensuring that he's still in business in years to come.
Yeah, there's not a lot of upside. But, you know, I mean, you can see how you set the odds on a football match or cricket or American football or, you know, even straight up politics. But how do you figure out the odds for something that's never happened before?
Well, you make a good point, and that is part of the profession, isn't it? It's basically putting out there your own opinion. We try to rub off the angles and edges at either end of the opinion, so you end up with somewhere in the middle which you think you can go to war with. If you're then unable to make a market at all, suspend the book, as we've done, until such time as the waters calm down a little bit.
Now, you have another, or you had, I suppose, another bet along these lines about whether the euro would still be around in what, I guess now 3 years or so, right? And you've stopped betting on that one as well.
Yes, we opened the market in 2010 as to whether the euro would still be around at the end of 2015. But obviously, should Greece exit or any other country, that could then lead to sort of mass evacuation of several countries, and all of a sudden it looks less and less likely that the euro would then be in place. So that's a related bet. So when we closed the market on Greece, we also closed or suspended for the time being the market on the future of the euro.
Right. You pay your money, you take your chances. Graham Sharp at William Hill, the bookmaker in London. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome.
The odds on Wall Street today were just about break even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A funny thing happened not long after the closing bell this afternoon. J.P. Morgan Chase said it would hold what you can only call a highly unusual conference call, during which CEO Jamie Dimon announced the bank's going to lose $2 billion on, in essence, a bad bet. Marketplace's Bob Moon is live in the studio with me to explain. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so $2 billion, a lot of money. What happened?
It is. We've talked for several years now about what some critics say is the equivalent of gambling by the big banks on Wall Street, something called synthetic credit securities, where essentially the bank bets on whether there will be a credit default by a particular entity, even if there's no direct link to that particular debt with the bank itself.
Mm-hmm.
This is something like AIG, for example.
Right, exactly. Credit default swaps, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. We hope it doesn't rise to that level, though.
Right.
But as you say, in this dramatic and contrite conference call tonight, the flamboyant CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, revealed that the bank lost around $2 billion in positions, read that, bets, made by its chief investment office. It could face an additional $1 billion in losses in the second quarter of the year because it says the financial markets have been so volatile. Now, Dimon said the bets have been used as an economic hedge by the bank. In other words, if the economy turned one way, these bets should have paid off. He says this portfolio proved riskier than expected.
Yeah, that's what I was saying to Mr. Sharp. You pay your money, you take your chances. Is J.P. Morgan Chase now, I mean, you said positions, right, and bets. This is real money, right? They're down $2 billion.
Well, it is, but keep in mind that there are other bets going on elsewhere.
Yeah.
So the losses were on these particular bets, but Dimon said they can offset some of these losses by maybe $1 billion or so by gains in other areas. Still, he blames these losses on what he called poorly executed, poorly monitored trading. He said it involves sloppiness and bad judgment on the bank's part. But in characteristic Dimon fashion, he's playing this down. He declared, "We will fix it and move on."
Yeah, well, let me stop you there. Isn't this what people have been worried about banks since the financial crisis? And isn't there the reform law and the Volcker rule and all this stuff to stop banks from playing the markets with their own money?
Yeah, I guess you could see that as collateral damage from Mr. Dimon's standpoint. He said it's unfortunate, but he does fear this is going to give new life to that debate.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
We have also talked a lot on the program, besides the banks, about the workers who assemble your iPhones and your iPads and what working conditions are like in Apple's Chinese factories. Rough is a word you might use. Really long hours, not always fairly paid. But today, Apple's contract manufacturer in China, an entirely separate company from Apple, by the way, announced it's going to improve those conditions and, get this, that its customer, Apple, is going to split the costs. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Your iPhone and mine get snapped together by a company Apple hires. Foxconn runs the factories. Foxconn's CEO today said he would cap worker overtime, improve labor conditions, and buy robots for the dreariest work. He says Apple, his customer, will split the initial costs, but it's unclear if that means 50-50. Either way, IT professor Jason Dedrick at Syracuse figures good PR move.
The public relations impact of these problems with the Foxconn factory on Apple has been, I think, significant enough that Apple feels that something needs to be done.
Normally, a brand name customer like Apple can squeeze its Chinese supplier dry. But with iPhones and iPads, Foxconn is one of the only outfits that can crank them out in a jiffy. So it may have some leverage to have Apple pony up for some cafeterias, dorms, and karaoke parlors on factory campuses.
Apple couldn't ditch Foxconn altogether by any means. And it's not just the scale that Foxconn has, but it's the capabilities they have for rapid ramp-up of production.
Apple may incur higher costs, but this is a company that can handle it. It's coming off a record quarter, largely because it sells gadgets at whopping profit margins. Analyst Jeffrey Wu is with IHSI Supply.
Apple does charge a price premium, and consumers are willing to pay. It's really not something Apple's competition can easily achieve.
And Apple's factory partner could use some financial help. Foxconn's operating profit margin last quarter fell to under 1%. Apple's dropped in at 39%. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So if I say chemistry, what do you think? People in white lab coats, right? Vials full of liquids, maybe? All right, how about this? Big business, big industrial business. Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, a company that wants to be the link between big industrial chemistry and consumers. Andrew Liveris is the CEO of Dow Chemical. I caught up with him at a Fortune magazine conference here in Southern California, and the first question was about those consumers.
Well, the last decade has seen us transform our portfolio, where over 70% of it now is either in material science or biological science. Of course, we still do chemical science. But these days, you may have seen our ads on TV, we are really branding Dow. I mean, the word chemical, of course, from a heritage point of view, is still in our name. But in terms of the brand, Dow and bringing solutions to consumers and to customers, that's the 30-second version.
What do you do when the first thing that most people think of when Dow Chemical comes to mind is, whatever they make is probably toxic, right? It's chemicals and hydrocarbons and holy geez, I don't want any of that stuff.
Yeah, it's a branding topic. So we've got to go out there and really re-educate humanity, because at the end of the day, 95% of all products out there have chemistry in them. Whether we like it or not, modern humanity, but even emerging humanity, needs chemistry to get clean water and affordable housing and medicines, and chemistry is ubiquitous. We at Dow already have 80% of all the products we make on the web in terms of product safety analyses. You can actually just access them. So you know what it is and what it does and what it doesn't do. And full transparency from this industry, full transparency to the ultimate consumer, is an absolute requirement. It's the right to operate. We are for smart regulations.
You are not, as they say, from around here. You're an Australian, obviously.
I'm closer to you than most parts of the country. I'm from Australia, so you're on the right side of the nation, at least.
That's right. I wonder, though, I mean, so I've got this theory that you can learn things about the United States when you travel overseas that you can't learn here. And I'd be curious as to your perspective as a foreigner, but one who has spent a lot of time in this country, what your take is on the wailing and gnashing of teeth of the loss of American industry and manufacturing.
The word manufacturing, you know, or even the word industry, just doesn't sit well. And people think about it as a smokestack environment or yesterday's era, and that everything should be services. And, well, last time I checked, you got to invent stuff, make stuff, and sell stuff. And then you'll service stuff. But if you don't do those first three things, who are you servicing? We really have to get our heads out of the notion that we can just be a service economy. The whole point I made from a Dow Chemical perspective is not only are we rebranding our company and rebranding our industry, we're rebranding what science, technology, engineering, maths means to this economy and how we can transfer that into American jobs for the next generation.
Andrew Liveris. He's the CEO of Dow Chemical. Thanks very much for your time.
All the best.
Chanel number 5. Brad Pitt says Angelina doesn't smell like this.
Coming up, schools as economic saviors.
We tried to create this vision of a one-stop shop.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 19 points today, a tenth of 1%, finished at 12,885. That's after six straight losses for the Dow. Thank you, Europe. The NASDAQ ticked down 1 point, a fraction of 1%, wrapped up at 2,933. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, 0.25%, ended at 1357. Tech giant Cisco Systems deleted 10.5% today. The maker of computer equipment dimmed its quarterly forecast because companies aren't willing to spend money right now. The business software company Salesforce.com fell 9%. Juniper Networks down 5%. Oracle down 2.75% today. Intuit unplugged 2%. Kohl's took off 4% today. The department store tried to lure in customers with lower prices, but earnings fell sharply. Live Nation Entertainment amped up 9%. The ticket seller wants to operate London's Olympic Stadium after the Summer Games end. News Corp beamed up nearly 5% today. The footwear maker Crocs sank 4.75%. I really still don't understand those things, I got to tell you. Wells Fargo rode up 1.7% today. Citigroup and Morgan Stanley each pocketed 0.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.87%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for April. How are we feeling about the economy? The University of Michigan issues its preliminary May Consumer Sentiment Survey. And it's a day to thank those married to the nation's men and women in uniform for their sacrifices. Tomorrow is Military Spouse Appreciation Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So you got your 1% and you got your 99%, and in theory, never the twain shall meet. That's kind of been the politics of the economy the past 6 or 8 months or so. Problem is, that's not actually what Americans think.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. He's here every week to give us a little bit of an attitude check today, how we feel about those who have more than most. Frank, it's good to talk to you.
Good to be with you, Kai.
So something a little bit different this week. We had our wealth and poverty folks go out and get a little tape, do a little man on the street survey. Unscientific, to be sure.
Sounds good.
About this topic. Here's what they said.
I don't knock anybody for being rich. They worked for it and they made it. That's good for them. I'm not mad at anybody.
Maybe someday you'll become hugely wealthy. It's just a pipe dream. It's not going to happen for 90% of the people in this country.
I don't think the problem is the rich people. It's easy to point fingers. I just don't think it's the rich people.
So do they have it right, Frank? I mean, do Americans not hate the rich for all the talk of 1% and 99%?
Remarkably, your not scientific sample there does reflect the data. This is really interesting. We had asked way back in 1990, Kai, some questions about the rich, and we just updated them. And lo and behold, little change. 63% of Americans say the U.S. benefits from having a class of rich people. Back in 1990, lo, those many years ago, that was 62%. So actually, that hasn't changed at all, as you say, despite all the discussion of the 1%. And 63% of Americans, Kai, would like to be rich themselves. And that's actually up from 59% 22 years ago. So not only do we think it's good to have rich people, we wish we could be rich.
Yeah. Yes, we do. There's another thing, though, actually, that goes along with that. And that is the self-identification. And here's another bit of tape.
If you only make it $50,000 a year, depending on where you live, you're just getting by.
$50,000 a year? Yeah, I would consider that middle class. I didn't consider myself terribly wealthy at $200,000 a year.
$250,000, I thought, well, once we reach that goal, life would be good. But after you deduct mortgage, college, insurance, you know, you're just getting by.
You know, that was interesting, right? We had a $50,000 person and a $250,000 person, both of whom say, yeah, I'm in the middle class.
Well, you know, that's not surprising. We have asked Americans, how much would it take for you to be rich? And, you know, about $200,000 is the average response, but it varies dramatically about how much money you make. If you're sitting there making $25,000 a year, to be able to make $50,000 or $75,000 would make you rich. But if you're making, like you heard, $250,000 a year, you say, geez, if only I made $500,000, then I would be rich. So everything is relative is what the data show.
There's an aspirational part of this too, right? I mean, do Americans, have you asked people, do they think they will ever be rich?
Ah, fascinating question. How likely is it you will be rich in your lifetime? And, you know, this is heartening. Of 18 to 29-year-olds, almost half. Kai, 47% say it's at least somewhat likely they will be rich at some point in their lifetime. Now, that drops dramatically by the time you're 65 plus, only 8%.
Yeah.
But still, 8% of seniors think they'll be rich someday if they just hold on long enough.
I want to meet that 8%, man.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's heartening that so many young people today are looking ahead and at least dreaming that someday they'll strike it rich.
Frank Newport, he's the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The partnership we do with them every week is called Attitude Check. There's more about it on our website, marketplace.org. Frank, we'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
education is the great equalizer, right? It's historically the path out of poverty in this country. But how do you get poor kids to do well in class if they're not getting enough to eat at home, or if they need glasses, or if their parents can't help them with their homework at night? But what if you took care of a lot of the stuff that's supposed to happen outside school, actually in school? In the second of two stories on education and poverty, Marketplace's Amy Scott takes us to a school in Cincinnati trying to do exactly that.
Charles Marsh has a sore throat.
Go ahead and stick it on up.
Big
Charles is a fourth grader at Euler School in Cincinnati's Price Hill. And today, instead of leaving school to see a doctor, he's walked down the hall to the health clinic, where nurse practitioner Dilruba Rahman takes a look.
So guess what, Charles?
She tells him he has strep.
I do?
Yeah, you do, unfortunately, but it's okay. I called in some antibiotic for you. Mm-hmm. It's going to be at the Walgreens. And
after school, free.
As soon as you go home, start taking it, and then you can come to school tomorrow, okay?
Most of the kids at Euler are considered poor. Without this clinic, a lot of them would get their basic care in emergency rooms. Instead, they come to Rahman for vaccinations, checkups, and when they're sick, and she bills Medicaid. Euler doesn't just have a health clinic. A dental van provides regular checkups, and an eye clinic will open next year.
We tried to create this vision of a one-stop shop.
Craig Hockenberry is principal at Euler.
So if a parent walks through our door right now and has a child that's sick, needs glasses, has a mental health issue, we don't have to send them anywhere else.
The school has three full-time therapists and a psychiatrist who can prescribe medications. Lower Price Hill, where most of the kids live, is one of the toughest neighborhoods in the city. Hockenberry says children at Euler are dealing with stresses most of us wouldn't believe.
Rape, murder, incest, incarceration, anything that you can imagine that goes along with poverty, and a lot of it went untreated. And over time, we were able to get the children into counseling, and we saw our suspensions and a lot of our behaviors go down.
In the late 1990s, the Ohio Supreme Court found the conditions of public schools in the state unconstitutionally bad. Leaders in Cincinnati decided to rebuild its schools as community learning centers, schools that would be hubs of their neighborhoods with an array of social services and after-school programs. Today, the district has one of the largest networks of community schools in the country. Darlene Kamine directs the Community Learning Center Institute. She says when she brought the idea to Lower Price Hill about 8 years ago, she was floored by the response.
The room was packed, standing room only, and out into the hallway with people who were quite angry.
At the time, Euler only went through eighth grade. Parents wanted a high school. The neighborhood is mostly urban Appalachian, that is, people mostly white with roots in the Appalachian Mountains. Kamine says the culture is so insulated, parents didn't want to send their children to high schools outside the neighborhood. So after eighth grade, most students dropped out.
Children from this neighborhood were, in fact, not graduating from high school. In the census data, there was no evidence that anybody in this community had gone to college at the time.
So they decided to rebuild Euler School as a community learning center that went all the way through 12th grade. Today, it has about 750 students. The school serves breakfast, lunch, and an afternoon snack. After-school programs include nutrition and computer classes and dance. Euler has college and career counselors, hundreds of volunteer tutors. Most of this is provided by nonprofits that operate rent-free in the school using their own funding. Every obstacle that poverty presents, absent parents, asthma, hunger, the school fights back with some service.
Fridays are probably the worst day of my week because I have to decide which of our kids are hungrier.
Coordinating all of these services is an ex-bank manager named Jamie Harris. Bracelets jangling, she walks several miles a day back and forth down the hallways, corralling kids.
Where are you supposed to be?
On Fridays, she sends the neediest students home with food to get them through the weekend.
We've got some beef stew. We've got red beans and rice. Usually cereal, a pudding, a fruit cup.
School leaders say this community approach is making a difference. Students are doing better on state tests. 6 years ago, Euler was considered an academic emergency by the state. Now it's making continuous improvement.
I think the biggest impact is that the kids are here.
Rachel Tapp teaches 5th and 6th grade math. She says when she started at Euler 10 years ago, attendance was phenomenally low.
And now, if they have a need, it's filled within the school and usually outside of the academic time, so they're in their seats and they're learning so much more of the time.
This spring, Euler will graduate its third class of seniors. One of them is Matthew Applegate. He didn't think he could afford college, but an Euler mentoring program taught him how to get financial aid.
That's always been a big goal for me, was to go to college. My family has never been real big in college, and I want to change that.
He starts at Cincinnati State this summer. Remember, just 10 years ago, almost no one from Euler finished high school. This year, out of 38 seniors, 36 are on track to get their diplomas. All of them have been accepted to college. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, our last pitches for that upcoming Brad Pitt Chanel No. 5 ad campaign.
Smell like Brad's Pits. Chanel No. 5.
So, you can smell like Brad Pitt, or you can smell like George Clooney. Which one will it be? Chanel No. 5.
Chanel No. 5. If you wear it, Brad Pitt will be your baby daddy.
The Marketplace players, ladies and gentlemen, send us yours, letters at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow put on 19 points, a 10th percent, finished at 12,855, the first up day in 7 trading sessions. The NASDAQ ticked down a point, a fraction of 1%, wrapped up at 2,933. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, a quarter percent, 1,357 is the number you're looking for. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.